For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Well, all right. So, last week and the week before both, there was this theme of pre-authentication of Jesus that, Jesus is not an isolated person who showed up, but is in fact a part of millennia's of planning that had gone into this beforehand on God's part. And it was, and part of this was laying down the prophetic record, which dictated in advance exactly what would happen in every phase of Jesus' life, his character, where he would come from, who he would be, what he would say, what he would do, and eventually his death and resurrection. Now, everything about him, his birth, was very well foretold. And that's a big theme here in the narrative that Matthew unfolds. Matthew is particularly interested in fulfillment. And he repeatedly has these what they call fulfillment formulas, of which we'll see several in the passage tonight. Most of these pre-authenticating prophecies could not have been faked, even if Jesus had wanted to. We see that there's nothing else like it in human history. There is no other authentic case. People talk about, people will talk about, well, Nostradamus predicted Hitler and all these different things, and stuff. And what you really need to do is go and look at those examples that they're citing and just see how hokey it is. There's nothing like this. All you have are a scramble of crazy words that means nothing, and that's supposed to be a prediction of Hitler. Well, yeah, you could read anything in there. One of the words in this nonsense rambling is the word hyster. And you're saying, well, that's pretty close to Hitler. It's like, no. And so there's really nothing like this anywhere else. And it's a marvelous system of pre-authentication that God, realized would be adequate, good and sufficient evidence for the reality of Christ. We can show that the predictions definitely precede the events that are foretold, and he has actually, we don't have to go back too far in history. If we go back 70 years now back in history, people could plausibly claim that some of the Old Testament texts may have been fiddled with by Christians to stick some of their material in and make it look like it was about Jesus after the fact. And then in the 1940s, the Dead Sea Scroll discoveries laid all of those kind of suspicions to rest. It was impossible to argue that anymore because those scrolls are from well before the time of Christ. And they have these very texts right there in them in black and white. So now Jesus, now this plan is coming to fruition. The promised one, the one that God has been talking about for centuries, for millennia before this, has now arrived. And he comes in this state, as we saw last week, of rejection. And it has to be born in a barn, in a stall, an animal stall, instead of, in the inn, which was too full for him. And that is in direct fulfillment of Isaiah's great prophecy of the servant of the Lord, that he was a despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. That chapter there, we didn't go over that last week or the week before, is one of the ultimate chapters predicting the life and the nature of Christ and his sacrificial death to pay for human sin, that the chastising of our sins fell upon him, and by his stripes we are healed, and his death, that he was cut off out of the land of the living, his resurrection, that God then would prolong his days, and his ascension into heaven, and how he would win faithful from every tribe on earth and so forth, and would see his offspring from every part of the world, and his glorification. I mean, this is all right there. And that's just one passage. So This is very important, and this is one of the themes then that Matthew continues to develop. Reading now from chapter 2, he says, Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea during the reign of King Herod. And about that time, some wise men from eastern lands arrived in Jerusalem asking, where is the newborn king of the Jews? We saw his star as it rose, and we have come to worship him. Now, Michael Green explains what probably the most likely scenario. I don't know if you've ever been down to the planetarium here in Columbus or in the Chicago Museum of Arts and Sciences. They often around Christmas time, they give a presentation on this. It's kind of cool. Maybe this is what it was. He says the most probable suggestion is that this was not a new star so much as the conjunction of Jupiter and Saturn in the area of the sky known as Pisces. A conjunction is when the planets look like they're coming one on right on top of the other practically. They're either real close or actually cross over in their paths. And that is a significant event in astrology. When planets have conjunctions, that means things are going to happen in connection with that. This happened three times in the year 7 BC. It was seen on the 29th of May, the 3rd of October, and the 4th of December in that year. A cuneiform inscription from the observatory of Zippar in Babylonia gives us this fascinating information. And of course, well, that's where we first read about it, but it is also confirmed today by modern astronomy, which can calculate these things forward or backward for thousands of years. We know exactly when conjunctions would have occurred. And that's the point they make when you see it in the planetarium. Okay, it's not difficult, Green goes on to explain, to see how they would have interpreted it. Pisces was reckoned by astronomers to mark the end of the sun's old course and the beginning of the new. Jupiter was the royal planet, and Saturn had long been the symbol of Israel. So this conjunction of planets giving the impression of one very bright star, that's why they say we saw his star, and it would look like one star, would have meant to the competent astronomer that a new age was beginning in which the sovereignty of the world would shift to Judea. Interesting. And you notice in the thing where they come in and talk to Herod and they say, we saw his star. So they've been traveling. They came from Persia, so they've come a long way. And then they came out and it says the star reappeared, right? And was over Bethlehem or whatever. And so and that happened. That literally happened because with retrograde motion, because it's not only that the planets are moving at different rates and cross each other, but the earth is moving. And so sometimes it will look like the planets go backward in their track and cross again. And that happened in this year, 7 BC, a year which would not be a bad guess. Definitely the birth of Christ had to be prior to spring of 4 BC because Herod, the man that was just mentioned, died in spring of 4 BC. So it was before that. He could have at the latest been born in early 4 BC or 5 or 6 BC would have worked as well. Anyway, it's interesting. Not only these magi, as they call them, these wise men, but there are various ancient records to the ferment in Israel at the time based on a famous Old Testament prophecy found in the book of Daniel chapter 9. The Jews knew that the promised Messiah was supposed to be coming sometime around this period. And we hear this echoed not just in the Bible, but also in secular, non-Christian, and anti-Christian sources. This is Suetonius, a Roman historian, in his book, The Life of Vespasian. He says, there had spread over all the Orient an old and established belief that it was fated at that time for men coming from Judea to rule the world. He says that was people all over the eastern end of the Mediterranean, that's what he means by the Orient, believed that men from Judea, that's the province that today is Israel, would rule the world. This prediction, referring really, he believed, to the emperor of Rome, as afterwards appeared from the event, the people of Judea took to themselves, and accordingly they revolted. So he says this is the explanation for why the Jews revolted against Rome in 66 AD. Off by 30 some years from the actual fulfillment of Daniel 9. But they didn't have accurate records. They couldn't tell exactly when the fulfillment was coming. But they did know that this was the general time. They knew that. Here's Tacitus, another Roman. Tacitus writes in his histories, he hates Christians. He thinks they deserve to die. But here's what he says about the Jews. He says, the majority of the Jews firmly believed that their ancient priestly writings contained the prophecy that this was the very time when the East should go strong and that men, starting from Judea, should possess the world. This mysterious prophecy had, in reality, pointed to Vespasian and Titus, but the common people, as is the way of human ambition, interpreted these great destinies in their own favor and could not be turned to the truth, even by adversity. Very interesting. Josephus says the same thing. They may be depending on each other. Not sure how they're getting this information, these Roman authors from later in the first century. But it's just interesting to see. I think every time that the biblical narrative, a lot of people think that the whole biblical narrative is just, you know, made up by Christians and has no bearing to anything outside of the Bible. That's simply not true. In fact, at many points of contact, and I think those are all interesting to look at. So anyway, these guys see the star. King Herod, we read, was deeply disturbed when he heard this, as was everyone in Jerusalem. Well, when Herod was deeply disturbed, automatically everyone in Jerusalem would be deeply disturbed. This guy was such a bloodthirsty despot. He was insanely paranoid, had grandiose delusions, but he was desperate to prevent someone from taking his throne. He actually executed his own wife and the two sons that she had borne him. He had other sons, though. He executed people all the time, slaughtered in great numbers. He had fought against the zealots and had crucified several thousand of their people in coming to power. And so he was just a slayer. And so, you know, you get a guy like Herod the Great upset, the whole city's upset because his heads are about to roll. And sure enough, that happened. He called a meeting of the leading priests and teachers of religious law, the scribes. And he said to them, where is the Messiah supposed to be born? So it's interesting. He knows enough to suspect that this might be it. This might be the Messiah. And these rumors were rife, according to the historians of the time. Josephus says that there was a great deal of ferment, people expecting the Messiah any day. And so here would be Herod and be like, whoa, this is it. He calls them in. They said, in Bethlehem in Judea, they said, for this is what the prophet wrote. And you, O Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are not least among the ruling cities of Judah, for a ruler will come out of you who will be the shepherd of my people Israel. We read that verse last week. Micah 5:2. They knew exactly they quoted this from heart by heart. They didn't even have to get out their Bibles and look it up. Everyone knew that prophecy. And now, so then Herod called for a private meeting with the wise men, and he learned from them the time when the star first appeared. He's already scheming. He already knows exactly what he's going to do. He's going to try to kill this baby. And the reason he's getting the time of the star's appearing is because he's figuring, I'm going to need to get anyone that old or younger. And maybe he probably gives himself a nice cushion just to be sure. Then he told them, go to Bethlehem and search carefully for the child. And when you find him, come back to me and tell me so that I can go and worship him too. Yeah, right. Well, they did. They went outside. Bethlehem is just, four or five miles from Jerusalem. It's a small village, very close, just to the south of Jerusalem. They go out and find him. They entered the house and saw the child. Notice they're in a house now. They were in a barn before. So some time has passed. So he is not a brand new infant anymore. And they find him in a house. They must have rented a house or something, and along with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshiped him, prostrated themselves. This word for worship is to prostrate, to bow. Then they opened their treasure chests and gave him gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. We do not know who these guys were. They don't know their names. Later, Christian legend assigned names to them and stuff. You hear that at Christmas time when people are, you know, movies and things like that. And none of that's real. We don't know their names. But these gifts are turned out to be very significant. When it was time to leave, they returned to their own country by another route, for God had warned them, not in a dream, not to return to Herod. The wise men. In Greek, magi or magos. This is the word we get magician from. They were a tribe of priests in Persia in the Zoroastrian religion. Zoroastrianism is... its beginnings are cloudy. It's not extremely clear. It is clear that there was a guy named Zoroaster it's named after. But their theology, some historians believe that they may have started out as theists, that they believed in one infinite personal God. So they would have the same worldview as the Bible. And may have truly even been believers in that sense. Later, they definitely went into dualism, and some believe they were always dualists. Others argue that dualism was a later development. Dualism is the view that there are two equal and opposite gods, a good and an evil God, and so and that battle between good and evil is an eternal battle because they're co-equal and neither one can beat the other. Dualism, which is still closer to the biblical picture. Than most worldviews. We believe in God and Satan, but they're not equal at all. Zoroastrians also accepted some forms of astrology, and we're not completely clear on this, but it's clear from these guys themselves would be one source that indicates that they did attribute meaning to the stars in the way that most ancient people did. And so this is an interesting point to think through and has to do with a subject we could call general revelation, all right? First of all, the zodiac and astrology and all of that is part of omen reading, and which is part of the occult, and the Bible says to stay well away from this, that this is superstition, and that, you know, the belief, one of the reasons that ancient people believed that the position of the stars and planets dictated what was going to happen is because they believed they were gods. They believed that when certain gods were in the ascendancy, because they were overhead, they were nearby, then those gods would prevail, and therefore you could predict what would happen based on that. So the whole assumption underlying astrology is polytheistic and goes directly against biblical teaching on monotheism. And, you know, if you've read your Bible, you know how God feels about that. Not too cool with that. And yet... So this is a pretty strange case to think about, because these guys are using an astrological technique here, an interpretation of stars, and they end up finding Christ through the means of something that we're not supposed to be doing. Isn't that a little odd, theologically? I think it holds together. We can read about Revelation in Romans 1, where Paul says that which is known about God is evident within people, for God made it evident to them. And so it's the argument of the Bible that we can look right within our own selves, and we see something within a personal being, that I am created at a very high level. I'm really not like the animals at all. And that this is true, not just in a superficial way, but at a very profound level, that my consciousness, my awareness, the vast intelligence that humans have, and their creativity, their aesthetic sense, their need for significance, their ability to love at a deep level is unlike other creatures that we see. And so it strongly suggests that there's a source here high, that's a high source of personal being, that we're created. He also says, for since the creation of the world, God's invisible attributes, his eternal power and his divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. People, there is ample evidence in our world for a God, a creator God. Oh, yes, there is. And if people won't acknowledge that, it's because they don't want to. But the evidence is right there. And in their heart, they know that, we all know, that a creator must exist. Or that at least, that it's highly probable. Okay? Now, when we look at these guys, so we take that background theology from the biblical picture. And we add it to the fact that these guys have come from Persia in a day when international travel was extremely difficult to do. These guys have probably been on the road for months. This would be a months-long journey of hundreds of miles through dangerous places to get from the Parthian Empire into the Roman Empire. They were enemies, and they've made it all the way over to Israel and are seeking around for this child. Okay, that's seeking. That is hardcore seeking. These guys really want to know something. You know, it's like they want to know the truth. They want to meet this king. And they must have assigned a spiritual significance to it. Because, kings rose and fell in these countries up and down all the time. And it would be implausible to think that they're journeying to every time a king is born, you know, that they journey over there to give them their gifts of treasures, of gold and so forth. It's ridiculous. It's clear that they think this is something spiritual, something important in the in the scope of the world, which it is. And so that is what you call spiritual hunger. There was an intense desire on their part to know about this birth that they believed had happened. That then triggers something that Jesus talked about and many other places in the Bible as well. For instance, in Matthew 7:7, where you will see Jesus teaching, ask and you'll receive. Seek and you will find. Knock and the door will be opened unto you. In other words, God is not holding back. You know, God is not the type of being who is like, I don't have to give you what I have to give here, and you haven't proven to me that you deserve it. And, we can imagine God being kind of tight-fisted, like I'm not giving out something unless I have to. And that's not the way he is. In fact, that God is eager to give out his love. He wants to get in with people. And so if people are looking for him, he's going to make sure they find him. Now, obviously, they didn't have access to the Bible because, and you see that in the scene where they have to get the scribes to come and tell them what the Bible says. They didn't have that information. So here are people who are spiritually hungry, they're seeking, they don't have the Bible, and then we realize that God, according to the Bible, watches for people like this. We see in Hebrews 4:13 that there is no creature hidden from his sight, but that all things are open and laid bare to the eyes of him with whom we have to do. God sees right into the hearts of people, right past the facade people put up, all of their phony words and everything else. He can see right into the heart. Here's another one, 2 Chronicles 16. The eyes of the Lord move to and fro throughout the earth that he may strongly support those whose heart is completely his. So God is always scanning for people that are interested in getting together with him. And he finds them. He would have seen these guys. And he is the one who has really guided them where they've come. In a word, he meets people where they're at. So they were astrologers. That was their worldview. They were mistaken on that point. Astrology is not valid according to the Bible. Even if it did accidentally tell the truth a few times, the point is, that was their worldview, so God came to meet them there because of their heart of desire to know him. And so it's an insight, it's an important insight into what we're really seeing here is the heart of God, what he's like. That he does, he's welcoming, he's friendly, he loves people. And if people will show an interest, you know, if they'll show any kind of seeking for him, then according to Jesus, seek and you will find. He'll make sure that you find it. He'll get you the rest of the information. This is the point of general revelation. The general revelation is for people that don't have access to the Bible. And so people are, I know I've talked to a lot of people here in this country who are very worried about this. What about people in countries, you know, that where Christianity isn't even there? They've never heard of this. Don't worry. It's a problem, yes. And I think we should try to get them that word. But there's definitely the possibility at all times that anyone who wants to look at the information or turn in their heart to God, that he's going to reach out to people like that. That's the way he is. Also interesting here, I think, is to contrast their attitude with the apathy of the scribes and priests who had come out. You know, it's like they come out to this meeting and they're like, where's the Messiah going to be born? Because we got some kings here that saw a star and all of this. And they're like, Bethlehem, Micah 2:5 or 5:2. And he's like, thank you. And they're just like, all right. And they sample back in. And it's like, what? You wouldn't think that they would be like, so something going on here maybe, huh? Maybe we should be, this is, after all, we're Bible believers, you know, or waiting for a Messiah supposed to be showing up here at some point. People all over the country are expecting the Messiah to come. And so you would fully expect them to be like, so guys, we'd like to ride down there with you. We want to see this also, you know, or something like that. And instead, it's just nothing. Apathy. Oh, that's really curious. That's pretty lame, really, when you think about it. I wonder if these guys were really even Bible believers at all. Anyway, from here on, the narrative switches over more and starts to focus on Herod and his bitter, hateful actions and the escape of the child from Herod. Let's think about that for a minute. Okay, verse 13. Now when they had gone, the wise men, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream and said, get up. Take the child and his mother and flee to Egypt and remain there until I tell you. For Herod is going to try, he's going to search for the child to destroy him. And so Joseph got up and took the child and his mother while it was still night and left for Egypt. Got the hell out of town that night. Good thing. Probably right ahead of the soldiers that were coming. He remained there until the death of Herod. This was to fulfill what had been spoken by our Lord through the prophet. Out of Egypt, I have called my son. Okay, so another fulfillment. This is to fulfill. Another fulfillment formula in Matthew. It's interesting that the Talmud, the Babylonian Talmud, agrees that Jesus went to Egypt. We read in Shabash 104b, Yeshua, that's Jesus in Hebrew, was a magician, and he learned his skills in Egypt. And that, this is a hostile source, obviously. also, the anti-Christian apologist Celsus, a second century attacker of Christianity, an opponent of Christ, quoted in Origen's book against Celsus, Jesus was brought up as an illegitimate child in Egypt, that he discovered certain miraculous powers, and then on returning to his own country, he used them to substantiate his claims to deity. Isn't that interesting that neither source, even though they both reject and deplore Jesus, admit that he was a miracle worker, that he performed wonders? Anyway, here's the problem with this passage, okay? Out of Egypt I have called my son. Comes from Hosea 11:1. Now, if you go read that passage and study the context, the son that was called out of Egypt in this passage is not Jesus, is not the Messiah, but is the people of Israel. It's referring to God rescuing the Israeli people from Egypt at the time of the Exodus. Moses, Pharaoh, all that stuff. Why then does Matthew say this fulfills what had been spoken through the prophet, out of Egypt I have called my son? We've had some very wild theories blown up here about how Matthew just follows a midrashic hermeneutic and so forth, none of which is valid or true. And I'll refer you to D.A. Carson's introduction to Matthew in the Expositor's commentary series, which is excellent, and he takes on this whole discussion. The fact is that Matthew's use of the word fulfill is different than most biblical authors. He's got a broader definition of what he means by that. The word plerao can mean to fulfill in the sense that a prediction is made and then fulfilled. That's one meaning for the word. But the word has a broader semantic range than that. It can also mean to fill up, and figuratively in the sense to resemble, that this fills up the meaning in that. In other words, it completes or carries further the meaning of something that was stated earlier, and in a sense resembles it or is parallel to it in a way. And so it's interesting to read the usage of the word, but it's obvious, and the main audience for Matthew's book were Jews. That's evident from a study of the book itself. He's writing primarily to Jews who would absolutely know this passage and wouldn't, again, Jews knew the Bible. Okay, that's all they studied when they went to school. They didn't study geography and math. They studied scripture. And they knew the Bible at a level that few here would know it, if any. So for him to quote Hosea 11:1, and they would know the context for that verse, no question about it. So, you know, it's obvious that he is not using fulfill in the usual sense. Carson explains that many have noticed how Jesus is often presented in the New Testament as the antitype of Israel, or better, as the typological recapitulation of Israel. Carson's a scholar, so he likes to use those kind of words. But essentially, that there is almost a reenactment of God's redemptive plan in Israel in the life of Christ. Let me show you how this works, explained again by Green. Israel became a nation after being called into Egypt, and the exodus from Egypt was the central point in the history of this nation that was becoming the people of God. Okay, that's a beginning point in Jewish theology, the Exodus. Pharaoh tried to destroy the people in Egypt, but Moses brought them out of Egypt into the land of promise. Now, Herod, a new Pharaoh, is trying to kill Jesus, the new leader, all right? And in his rage and frustration, he slaughtered other innocent firstborn children in Bethlehem. He failed to kill Jesus just as Pharaoh had failed to kill Moses. Remember how Pharaoh was saying all Jewish males have to be executed? And that's why they put him in that basket thing and put it out on the river. And he winds up getting... And it was all the hand of God. All of it was the hand of God that was protecting Moses, because Moses was going to be the deliverer. Eventually, Moses brought the children of Israel out of the land of bondage and death. And in this case, now Moses' successor was to bring the people out of a worse bondage and a worse death, the death that comes from sin, to free the people from sin. And so there does seem to be this is what Matthew is saying, is that it's what we call typical thinking, typological thinking, where there's a type and an antitype, something here and something that resembles it over here. And this is what this is in this case. There are clear, valid parallels between the history of Israel and their redemption from Egypt by Moses and the picture that is made here. I think it's misleading. Well, okay. Let's keep going. Verse 7. When Herod saw that he'd been tricked by the Magi, he became very enraged and sent and slew all the male children who were in Bethlehem and all of its vicinity from 2 years old and under, according to the time which he had determined from the Magi. So now we see why he wanted to know when the star appeared. And it's, you know, and he's probably given himself a sizable cushion here. No telling how long it had been since the Magi had visited him, but long enough for him to realize they weren't coming back. This slaughter, very typical of Herod. Anyone that looked funny at Herod was liable to die. He was a renowned killer. The number of children killed in this sweep may have been pretty small. This village of Bethlehem would have been quite small, a few hundred people. And how many 2-year-old males that would be in that area, hard to say. What had been spoken through Jeremiah the prophet was fulfilled. Here's another fulfillment formula. A voice was heard in Ramah, weeping and great mourning. Rachel weeping for her children. And she refused to be comforted because they were no more. A passage from Jeremiah, yeah. Jeremiah 31:15. Which again, now, if we go to that passage, this raises the curious question of the New Testament's use of the Old Testament. Again, we will find this is not referring to the Messiah. This is referring to a slaughter of people that happened when the Babylonians deported the Jewish people near where Rachel had been buried. Rachel, the wife of the original Jacob, Israel, who had, and so it's her descendants, her children, that were being deported and killed. It's not about the Messiah. And so, again, we have a type of fulfillment that is not to be thought of in the sense of fulfilling what the author intended this as a prediction of the Messiah, but rather this is more in the form of an allusion. This would be sort of like saying, this basically is similar. This was like, you know, when Gandalf fell off the bridge down into the pit with the Balrog, you know, this was like that. And so you're referring to literature that people are familiar with, or cinema or whatever, as something that is similar, that is resembles what's going on here. And it reminds him of it, but he's using it, fulfillment in that broader sense again. Finally, we read, when Herod died, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt and said, get up and take the child and his mother and go into the land of Israel, for those who sought the child's life are dead. So this would be 4 BC by now. So Joseph got up, he took the child and his mother, came to the land of Israel. But when he heard that Archelaus was reigning over Judea in place of his father Herod, this was but through a different wife. Herod had a total of 10 wives eventually. He didn't kill all of the other 9, but he was afraid to go there. And then after being warned by God again in a dream, he left the regions for the regions of Galilee. That would be the northern part of Israel, rather than the southern part where Jerusalem was, where Herod was. And so he came and lived in a city called Nazareth. This was to fulfill what was spoken through the prophets. He should be called a Nazarene. Yet another fulfillment statement. This one is quite odd because that statement is actually not even in the Old Testament. It's probably referring to Isaiah 11:1, which says, then a shoot will spring from the stem of Jesse. And if you read Isaiah 11:1, like just read 1 through 10, you will see this is a passage about the Messiah. This is definitely a passage. This is the one about the lion will lie down with the lamb and a child will lead them and, you know, peace all over the whole earth and all that kind of thing. And it's King Messiah all the way. The term shoot or branch in Hebrew is Natsar. And it is actually believed that Nazareth got, you know, is based on that stem because of the vineyards around there, having something with a branch. And so I think, and it's funny that Matthew is like, kind of saying it's ironic that he's called a Nazarene, which is similar to the Nazar that is supposed to spring from the stem of Jesse. It's a little misleading, I think, to have quotation marks around this like this. Because remember now, in the original texts of the Bible, there are no punctuation marks whatsoever. It's all, you determine the punctuation by the spelling of the words, and the interpreter, the translator, has to decide when a quotation is. It's actually pretty hard to read these texts. They don't put spaces between the words either. It's just a stream of letters packing a page. I can't even read them. And I studied Greek for a sizable time, and I cannot read these unsealed texts at all. I can pick out a few words, but it's just really hard to read. Anyway, putting quotes around this makes it sound like he's quoting from the Old Testament, whereas what he's actually doing is just alluding to something in a general way. It's clearly not an exact quotation. It's just an allusion to something. And so, again, we can't press this fulfillment in the case of Matthew to mean in every case. Now, there are cases where he cites actual prophecies about Jesus and says they were fulfilled, like the one about him being born in Bethlehem. But he also uses different types of fulfillment. And so, in Matthew 2, we see three reactions to Jesus. I think this is the take-home value in this story. First of all, Herod. Was it hatred or was it fear that drove him to his brutal act? He's totally cynical. He doesn't care whether there's a valid sign in the skies or whether it's the Messiah down there. He couldn't care less. And in fact, if it really is the Messiah, it's clear that Herod suspects that it might be. And that's exactly why he's determined to kill him. He's determined to keep his own power. Why is Herod so vicious in this story? It's because these guys are coming and saying that there's a star saying that the king of the Jews has been born. And Herod's like, dude, the Jews already have a king, right? Et moi. This is Herod's problem. Herod is not about to share his sovereignty with anyone. And even if it's God. And so in that sense, he becomes typical of an attitude that we may still find from people today. An attitude that simply says, nobody is going to tell me what to do. Period. And, you know, I have even gotten as far with people. I've been involved in lengthy, dialogues with friends where we've talked about whether God is real, whether the Bible, is inspired or not, and I've gone through all these different things. Nothing seems to matter. You know, you get this feeling, one question gets answered, and all of a sudden it's a different question, and if that one, and the questions keep shifting, and you start to get this feeling that, so you're really not interested in finding the answer to your questions, are you? I've even asked people, what if it was finally and conclusively to your satisfaction demonstrated that Jesus was the Messiah of God and has the solution to your life and the universe, that he's God? Would you follow him then? And had people say, no. And then you just realize, well, so this whole talk has been a big waste of time. And they're like, I'm not going to grovel in front of some God or whatever, and that's their attitude. And it really pisses them off a lot of times. People get surprisingly angry talking about God and Jesus, in particular, the God of the Bible. They don't seem to get angry if you talk about other religious figures. Buddha is supposed to be an incarnation of God. That doesn't seem to get them angry. It's only when we talk about Jesus and the God of the Bible, there's this fury, this kind of reminds you of Herod. At the other extreme, of course, were the wise men. These guys were seekers in the real sense. They weren't pretending to be seekers. The kind of pseudo-seeker that is like, well, I'm on a quest, but I know I'll never find an answer. Now, wait a minute. If you've already decided that you'll never find an answer, then you're probably really not on a quest, are you? To be an honest seeker, to be a real seeker, you have to be open to the possibility, at least, that there might be an answer. Otherwise, you're just pretending to seek. You've already decided there's no answer, and so it's pseudo-seeking. Not these guys. This was real seeking, where they're actually looking for an answer. They wanted to know the truth, and they were prepared to follow it. In between comes the most bizarre group of all, and of course, well, yeah, they found it. In between, the most bizarre group, the scribes and the priests. Here were the guys that really had the information. Here were the guys that were totally in a position to know. And they're just apathetic, probably preoccupied. You know, they probably left this meeting about where's the Messiah to be born and went back into their back room for a nice theological argument of some sort. I'm sure they were doing something. Probably just too preoccupied with that to be interested in, so we could actually have the Messiah being born down a few miles from here. Apathy. Well, obviously, I'm here to not just describe this situation, but to argue a point. My first point is that to be like Herod, you know, and I've had people actually ask me before, so what if I just don't want to grovel in front of God and I just don't want to follow him? You know, even if he's there. What of it? And it'll be, what of it? You're a fool. That's what. If God is there, if this is the truth, we're going to have to adjust to that truth at some point. And only a fool would put that off. If this is really true, we got to come to grips with this. First of all, knowing God and having him in your life is probably be the ultimate thing that you could do to enhance your life immediately, because you would now be living as you were created to live, in union with God and not separated from him. And, you know, eventually we're going to face God if he's really there. If the biblical message is true, we're going to stand before God, every one of us. It says every knee is going to bow, so everyone's going to bow to him eventually anyway. But for many, it'll be too late, and they'll come under the judgment of God. You say, what's wrong with this position? That's what's wrong with it. You're a fool because you've already decided to reject God out of sheer pride, is all it is, the determination that I am the captain of my life and nobody's telling me what to do. And you're going to be judged for that. You will come under the judgment of God. That's not excusable. People that are into just being preoccupied and apathetic, hey, that beautifully describes so many people in our day. What a horrific response. What could you be preoccupied about that's so important that it would mean putting off finding out about this? You know, How could you not care? I've had people just say, well, I'm busy and I really don't care about it. You don't care what you are as a being, why you're here? You don't care what happens to you when you die? How can you not care about that? If you didn't care about that, it's because you don't want to think about it. It's because it probably scares you or something like that. It's just, it's fascinating. I used to be a hardcore atheist myself, very hostile to Christianity, but I always knew this was the most important question around. I always knew that. That if a God existed, that would change everything. And so anybody who feels like they're just too apathetic to check into the reality of God in a deep way, I think, is also a fool. These guys, this is what we need right here. This is what Matthew's arguing. You know, he's showing us models here, and he's pointing us toward, here are people who knew nothing of God, who were from a distant land, who were working through actually a lot of superstitious, you know, beliefs and stuff. But in the heart was not this cold, rejecting attitude, was not this selfish, autonomous attitude, this brash flaunting of the self and of personal pride, but is humble enough to be like, you know, if God is there and if we can meet this king, we will travel over and we'll seek him out and find him. And we want to find him, and so that we can bow down before him. And to them, again, we have Jesus' promise, seek and you shall find. So that's something to really think about. You may have come here tonight. You might be a seeker. Why else would you be sitting here? You must be a seeker, right? And Jesus says, if you seek, you find. So you can, he also says, ask and it will be given to you. You can just, even without fully understanding the whole picture, you can just ask God to kind of show me the rest of the picture here, to kind of give me the rest of the story. Show me if you're there. Speak to me. Come to, you know, act in my life. And God looks for the people that have that attitude. He sees you. He hears you. And he'll answer. And that, I think, is the lesson of Matthew 2.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.